Hi. So first, I want to give everyone a great Mazel Tov on the Siyumim. It's a tremendous accomplishment, and may HaKadosh Baruch Hu give you the zechus to make many more Siyumim and finish Bavli, Yerushalmi, and many more Svarim. So I know that you're going to be having a big celebration at 7, so we're going to stop like a minute before 7 or so, so you can set up everything. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. You could even get an art scroll. This is exactly what the Gemara in Megillah means. Remember, the Gemara in Megillah says that Yonasan ben Uziel, the greatest of the Talmidim of Hillel, wrote a Targum on Nevi'im. That's Targum Yonasan. And then he began to write a Targum on Ksuvim. And then there was an earthquake in Eretz Yisrael where HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not let him do it because Mi Gila Labanai Razeh, who's able to reveal the secrets? And the pshat is very simple, that in the Ksuvim, particularly the book of Daniel, there is a detailed calculation as to when Mashiach will come. There are formulas. There are actually 5 different dating systems that HaKadosh Baruch Hu used in communicating to Daniel when will be the Kates. Of course, even the Kates is not so pashut. Does Kates mean Mashiach? Does it mean Tchias HaMeisim? Does it mean Binyan Beis HaMikdash? Even that exact Nakuda is not clear, but there are 5 different systems. And if you look at Rashi, Rashi tries to reconcile all the systems to turn out the same, Ramban. And basically, in the time of the Ga'inim and the Rishainim, they tried to figure out what those Cheshbainis were. And they came up with different dates, and all of those dates passed. So according to Rashi, it was typically like 100 or so years ahead of where you were. So Rav Sadia Gaon put it in the 1000s, and Rashi put it in the 1100s, and the Ramban put it in the 1200s. The last of our Meforshim that tried to do that was the Malbim. The Malbim wrote in the 1900s, and the Malbim came up, or I'm sorry, the 1800s, 19th century, and the Malbim came up with 1920 as Yemos HaMashiach, based on his understanding of the Pesukim. Now, there are 2 different issues I want to discuss here. Issue number one is, what about the fact that Chazal pronounce a curse on those who try to calculate, mechashve kates, those who try to figure out when Mashiach comes. Tipach rucham. They should burst. They should be destroyed. So how could all these rishayim be mechashve the kates? And it's so interesting. In one of the letters of the Rambam, when somebody asked him about Mashiach and different calculations, so the Rambam quotes all the Mamari Chazal that you shouldn't do it, it's usher to do, it's no good to do, it's bad to do. But then he says, but, you know, my father gave me a remez that he got from his rabbi. You know, so the Malbim tries to be miyashiv. The Malbim gives a teretz, but it's a very, on the estaiti, it's a very short teretz. The Malbim tries to say that the isra being mechashiv kates is only when the date that you've seen is a date that's long in the future. Because if you tell people that the date of Mashiach is going to be, you know, 1,000 years from now, they're going to be tzebrachen, they're going to be heartbroken, they're going to give up hope, and they're not going to realize, of course, that even if there's an outside date, we can always accelerate Mashiach early. Mashiach King, the Malbim says, when your date is in the near future, that's not going to be a problem. Now, Lanias Daiti, it's a very schwer teretz, because if anything, I think to come up with a close date is much worse, potentially, than a far date. Because a close date, the date comes and it goes, and it doesn't happen. What's going to happen to people? If anything, people might get more tzebrachim. So the Malbim Svara only makes sense if you know your date is right. If you know your date is right, so no, I'm going to tell you in 10 years Mashiach is going to come. But if you really don't know, you're just giving pshatim in a pasuk, then pumfakert. It seems the sakana of a recent date is more dangerous than a long-term date. Now, the second kasha I want to raise is, so what's the pshat? Rav Sadia Gaon comes up with a date. And actually, it's very interesting. It's very fascinating, I guess, in terms of pshat in the psukim, the ingenuity, because the psukim are so obscure, so difficult, and to be able to fend for the psukim is just very, very fascinating. But all the dates are wrong. Rav Sadia Gaon's date was wrong. Rashi's date is wrong. Ramban's date is wrong. Malbim's date is wrong. So what's the pshat? Do we say that the Rishayim made mistakes? So here you have to understand a very important thing about, I might say, biblical prophecy in general. That is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu often gives nevuahs that can be interpreted in many, many different ways. And which way it will happen is totally on the zechus of Am Yisrael. So the emes is, I guess, the emes is, it's not the pshat, the nevuah meant a particular date and not the other dates. The nevuah was bedafka worded that each of those dates could have been a zaman of his eiris of geula, had we been worthy. So Rav Sadia Gaon's date was a possibility. And in fact, different svarim try to do this, although I can't say I have a full grasp of it. They try to show that in each of those years, there were certain events that were merames to Geula. In Rav Sadia Gaon's dates, in Rashi's dates, in Ramban's dates, and even in the Malbim's dates. So the concept is this. When a nevuah is obscure, it's not the pshat, it has a single meaning, and you're trying to find out what that meaning is. Rather, the meaning is indeterminate, and it will be chal based on the Zechus of Am Yisrael. A very good example in the Torah itself is the 400 years of the Bris Bein Absarim. HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Avram, your children will be enslaved in a land that is not theirs for 400 years. Now we know that they were only in Mitzrayim 210 years, and you count it from the birth of Yitzchak and the like. But the Mefarshim tell us that the emes is, it could have taken many, many different forms. It could have been counted from here. We would have stayed longer had we not been in the 49th level of Tumah. We should have stayed longer. Alibit the emes, the Sfarim say, had we stayed the extra 190 years in Mitzrayim, we would have been purified from our Zuhama. But the problem was we would have hit the 50th level, so we couldn't have gone through that process. It's like chemotherapy that kills the patient. So Elamai, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave the Nevuah in a way that it could be fulfilled this way, or that way, or that way, or that way, and any of those ways would have been a valid Kiyum of the Nevuah. Okay, so you can look at the book Daniel, and again, I think what the Art Scroll does, L'mashal, is it does give you the different calculations. Obviously, Art Scroll does not take sides, and when Mashiach is going to come, it's not going to tell you. But the Rishayim did use the book of Daniel as a Mafteach. For the Inyanim of Geula. By the way, the well-known Mesorah of Chazal, that the Bayis Sheni was 420 years. And this is actually very, very problematical in terms of secular history. This is because it seems that the Second Temple was much longer. But it's Miyusad on a verse in Daniel. What was Machriach Chazal to come up with the 420 years was that the Pasuk says Hashem was geyser on Yerushalayim 70 weeks. 70 weeks. Now a week in that Pasuk means 7 years. It's called a Shavua. 70 weeks is 490 years. Chazal understood that Pasuk to mean that from the Churban Bayis Rishain to the Churban Bayis Sheni is 490 years. And since we know from the Churban Bayis Rishain to the Binyan Bayis Sheni is 70 years, 490 minus 70 leaves you with 420. So the Cheshbon of Seder HaOlam, which is the Chazal's chronological work, is based on Shivim Shavuos, our Nigzer. So Daniel is a very, very interesting book in terms of going through the different Rishayim on it. In fact, the Yabar Benel wrote literally three different Svarim on Daniel. One is a Pasuk by Pasuk Pshat, like the Yabar Benel writes generally, and the other were trying to explain the Messianic prophecies. He came up with another date around the Spanish Inquisition that many, many people thought that was the Gaigu Magog that would be the precursor to Mashiach. Oh, by the way, I want to correct something I said. I kept on using the words Nevuais, Nevuais, Nevuais. Now let's think about that for a moment. Sefer Daniel, although there are so many predictions about the future, obviously, Daniel is not in the Sifrei Nevi'im. Daniel is in the Sifrei Kesuvim. And one might ask Akasha, what's the Nafkamina? And in fact, the Gemara in Megillah says Daniel was not a Navi. What's the Pshat Daniel was not a Navi? I understand why Tehillim, let's say, so Tehillim are praises of Hashem. All right, but why would a Sefer like Daniel not be called Nevuah? Why would Daniel not be a Navi? He had future visions communicated to him by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The answer is this. This is a very important insight. What makes a Navi is not that he sees the future. Great, great tzaddikim can be seen as the future. What makes them a Navi is they are commanded by HaKadosh Baruch Hu to communicate a message to Am Yisrael. The word Navi does not refer to what you see. Navi means Niv Sefasayim, what you communicate. And although Daniel was the repository of great, great future understandings, they were given to him as a private matana, so to speak, from the Ribbono Shel Olam, and he was not commanded. He was allowed to write them down, but he was not commanded to be mefarsim them. In fact, the Kodesh Baruch Hu's lashon was, write them down and keep them obscure, meaning don't explain them. So as a result, Daniel had tremendous havana, but Daniel was not a Navi. And that's why his sefer is in the Ksuvim, not the Navi. Okay? Yeah. Anything else? There's a, okay.
I don't really understand the idea of Pelegish.
Well, it's a big machlokas rishainim. How do you understand Pelegish? According to the Rambam, Pelegish. Now, again, first of all, there are two questions here. First of all, what is a Pelegish? That's what question number one. Question number two is, when is a Pelegish permitted and when is it forbidden? What is a Pelegish? We have a machlokas. One opinion says a Pelegish is a woman that you have not married. It's a mistress. But she's not a prostitute. She has a permanent relationship with you, but she without marriage. That's a Pelegish, an out-of-wedlock, steady relationship as opposed to a promiscuous one. According to another opinion, a Pelegish is married, but it's an agreement not to have a kesuva. So there's a machlokas. Is it Pelegish b'li kedushin, or is it Pelegish kedushin b'li kesuva? Most Rishayim say Pashut Pelegish is without Kedushin. So let's go with that definition. But Machlokas number two is, when is a Pelegish butcher? So according to the Rambam, it is usher d'oraisa for a regular Jewish person to have relations with a woman outside of marriage. It's an usher d'oraisa. It's a love. It's not a chiyuv karis. There's no mamzeris, but it is a love. And the whole heter of Pelegish is a special rule only for a melech. It is the prerogative of a melech. A melech has many, many prerogatives, many, many zechuyos, and Pelegish is one of them. This is how we generally paskin. So unless somebody's a melech, we would consider Pelegish to be asur d'oraisa. However, now to be totally honest, there is a minority of Rishonim, and an Achron like Rav Yaakov Emden, who often has kind of unusual das yochid opinions, who actually says that la halacha, a Pelegish is mutter even to a hedgeite, and without getting into various scandals in New York and other places, there is a small segment of the religious community that has used Rav Yaakov Emden to matter things that the Torah community would generally not permit. Let me point out a very simple thing, though. That is that even if a Pelegish is mutter, certainly a Pelegish that's a nida would not be mutter. So then you would have to create a whole scenario where single women would be going to the mikvah. Okay, so that's what a Pelegish is. Yeah.
So the rabbi said that it doesn't produce mamzerim, but
see, Baruch Hashem, it doesn't.
What is it?
Yeah, yes, it does. It does. A child born out of... First of all, even a mamzer inherits equally. Even if, God forbid, a woman were to commit adultery and have a child from a man that's married, the mamzer would inherit equally with the man's, you know, the adulterer's other children and the like. So the Gabi inheritance, mamzeris, doesn't do anything negative. But a mamzer has prohibitions on who he could marry, who he or she could marry. But a child born out of wedlock, Baruch Hashem, has no disabilities at all. And let me tell you why that's an extremely important bit of information to know. Now, good. Most people, let's say, who are Chozrei B'tshuva, good. Their parents were not living out of wedlock in a sense the way we normally understand it. But keep in mind that if they didn't have a kosher marriage, if they didn't have kosher edim, it's entirely possible that in the eyes of halacha, their parents' marriage is not a marriage. And if in the eyes of halacha, their parents' marriage are not a marriage, then they are born out of wedlock. But that shouldn't scare anybody, because being born out of wedlock is not a problem. Two things. Hashem had rachamim, because he saw, HaKadosh Baruch Hu knew, that there would be a whole movement of Balei Tshuva. One is that out of wedlock relationships don't produce mamzer. And the other is a relationship with a nida doesn't produce a mamzer. Now, in truth, that's an exception from the rule, because the normal rule of mamzer is any relationship for which the punishment is kares produces a mamzer. By that definition, a ben nida ought to be a mamzer. But imagine how many mamzerim there would be if there would be such a halacha. So, Baruch Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, a child of a nida is not a mamzer. There is no problem. And the other thing that's amazingly helpful is it actually is helpful in some cases to have parents who are not halachically married. And this is extremely helpful if you are, for example, a child born from a second marriage and your mom did not get a get from her first marriage. So you got a real problem here, theoretically, because if mom didn't get a get from her first marriage, she's still married to her first husband. So when she, even with a civil divorce, so when she marries husband number two, the child would be conceivably a mamzer, but we rely on a very well-known psaka of Rav Moshe Feinstein that says that if marriage number one did not have kosher edim, it is therefore invalid, and an invalid marriage does not need a get. If it does not need a get, then marriage number two does not produce mamzerim. And if you're going to say, oh, but if you're invalidating marriage number one, you're also invalidating marriage number two, which may have been non-halachic. But that's okay, because invalidating marriage number two just means you're born out of wedlock. It's a lot better to be born out of wedlock than to be a mamzer. So this works out well. Now, not all the poskim agreed with Rav Moshe. And the Yemes says Rav Yashiv Lechatchila was also machmer. There are poskim that say that even if a marriage is initially invalid, if they live together as husband and wife, and there are religious people who are aware of that, they become the witnesses making it a marriage, which means, according to this psak, civil marriages, reform marriages, can morph into halachic marriages simply by them living together with other religious Jews knowing about it. This was the psak of Rav Henkin, who was very chashuva paisek and slightly older than Rav Moshe and the like. But as I say, at least when it comes to mamzeris,
and it requires a get?
It certainly requires a get, yeah. But more than that, requiring a get is not as serious as the child being a mamzer. But legabi mamzeris, the Torah world is presently makel, like Rav Moshe. Yeah. You talking about Pilegesh?
Yeah.
Oh, go back to Pilegesh. You know, it's an interesting question, because under Torah law, of course, a husband can marry two wives, and you don't need your wife's consent. But at least for Ashkenazim, since the 1100s, since the 11th century, the 1000s, we have the famous Takana of Rabbeinu Gershom. Right? You all heard of Rabbeinu Gershom. Rabbeinu Gershom was an enormously great Gadol. He was the Rebbe of Rashi's Rebbe, so he's before Rashi. And Rabbeinu Gershom made a takana for the Jews in Germany and Poland, Ashkenazic Jews, that there's a prohibition of polygamy, right? So I'm not allowed to marry another wife. So the question becomes, and that's even if she gives me permission. Now, those who matir Pilegesh say that since Pilegesh is without marriage, you're not marrying another wife, you're just having a mistress, and that's not having another wife, so you do not need the wife's permission. But I would not recommend it for Sholem Pius concerns, if for no other reason. But besides that, let me just reemphasize that according to the Rambam, for a non-melech to have a Pilegesh would in fact be a Torah prohibition. It wouldn't just be a Sholem Pius type of problem. By the way, yes, I mentioned Ashkenazim. So two things about Rabbeinu Gershom's ban. There are actually two things he banned at the same time. Number one, he prohibited polygamy, taking another wife. And number two, he prohibited divorcing a woman against her will. Now, all you guys know from your learning in the 8th parak of Gittin that the Torah basically allows me to throw a get in my wife's courtyard and all sorts of things, whether she likes it or not. That's all the law of the Torah, and even Midrabanan. But according to Rabbeinu Gershom, a man is not allowed, unless she consents, generally speaking, we do not allow him to divorce her, right? So as a result, he can't marry another wife, and he cannot divorce her against her will, which means the question of aguna, when a woman is stuck because a man doesn't give her a get, can also apply to a man. If a woman refuses to receive a get, he could be stuck with the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom. Now, there are two things people say. A smart Alex always like to tell you, oh, well, you know, if you looked in Rabbeinu Gershom's ban, it was only until the year 5000. It had an expiration date, and therefore it expired 774 years ago, and therefore it's mutter. Well, all of that is true, but the Beis Yosef informs us that the ban was extended by the later Chachamim, so it's in effect. But the second thing is that since Rabbeinu Gershom's jurisdiction, so to speak, was only among Ashkenazic communities, which is a broad category, really, in Germany, Poland, Lithuania, Russia, it did not embrace Sephardic communities, which are really North Africa, Syria, Iraq, those countries. So technically, Sephardim are allowed to marry two wives. And indeed, when the Yemenites came to Israel, at first in the 1940s, there were some older people. I don't think there's anyone alive today, but some older people brought multiple wives. But what Sephardim do to this very day is they have a what you might call a privatization of the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom, meaning in the Sephardic Ksuva, which is much longer than Ashkenazic Ksuva, they actually say that the Chassan swears with a severe oath that he will not take another wife over this wife, and if he does so, he will immediately divorce the first wife with $1 million ksuva. They put in a huge ksuva, which basically says, yeah, you're free to violate, you're free to marry another wife, but if you do so, you're going to have to pay my daughter, you know, $2 million. So that's what you might call a privatization of the Chaim of Rabbeinu Gershom. Also, in 1948, the two chief, or 40, maybe 1950, the two chief rabbis, the Ashkenazic chief rabbi, was Rav Yitzchak Herzog, and the Sephardic was Rav Uziel. They made a joint takana that Sephardim and Eretz Yisrael would be makabel, the chayim of Rabbeinu Gershom. And as a result, based on that takana, except for the grandfather clause allowing people who already had multiple wives, Sephardim are bound by that takana. On the other hand, I saw a tshuva from Rav Avadya Yosef, who actually says that the Sephardic chief rabbi didn't have the power to give away the minhag of Sephardim to allow something. So he actually says the takana of his predecessor on Sephardim was batel u'mavutal. So there's even a machlokas. If Sephardim in Eretz Yisrael are bound by the takana. Again, Rav Avadya had a whole shita that he felt that Sephardic rabbis were giving up too much authority to the Ashkenazic rabbinates, and they had no right to just sell them out, so to speak. So there's a big machlokas among Sephardim whether there is a takana in Eretz Yisrael that they cannot, that they're bound by Cheir de Rabbeinu Gershom. Okay, so that's that. Yeah.
What is kavana?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. In fact, a friend of mine, not a friend of mine, but at least an acquaintance I know from Connecticut, wrote a very, very nice book in English. It's around 600 pages. Called Kavana. So you might want to look it up somewhere. So it goes through all different sources. What is Kavana? And there are different forms of Kavana. But the word Kavana literally means direction, focus. Lechaven is to direct my hand, right? Even if I want to, you know, move something, I want to get something. So I have to be mechaven my yad, right? So Kavana is direction, and it really means focused thoughts. Our problem is that our minds are distracted constantly. We're constantly seeing things, thinking of things, many, many different thoughts pass through our minds. We get distracted. We get distracted in everything we do. We get distracted in learning. If you're talking to me, you know, my mind might be thinking about some problem I have or what I'm going to eat for dinner tonight, and you might be thinking of something else, right? So one of the most difficult things for a human being to accomplish is to focus on a single thing. Meditation is directed to that idea of learning to focus by shutting out. So consequently, kavana is not a term that is miyuchad to prayer. Kavana is the general idea of focus. Focus without distraction, without static, without other things coming into your mind. Now, for tefillah, there is a special rule that in tefillah, we have to be mechaven es libo. So I want to emphasize, people make a mistake. They sometimes think kavana is connected to understanding what you're saying. I mean, not really. It's true that if you understand what you're saying, you can focus better. And it's true there are other halachas that you're supposed to understand certain parts of davening. For example, but not that many, by the way. You have to understand the first pasuk of Shema, and you have to understand the first bracha in Shemona Esrei. The rest of Shemona Esrei, even if you don't know what you're saying, you're yotzei. But kavana would mean that you're focused, that you're speaking to Hashem, and you don't allow other thoughts. Now again, for Shteitzach, there's a very close relationship between knowing what you're saying and having kavana, but they are two different concepts. The kavana is not to be distracted by other thoughts. And that's what kavana, that's a very, very difficult thing. Rav Aryeh Kaplan, Aleph HaShalom, was a big proponent of kosher forms of meditation. He wrote three books on meditation. Jewish meditation, meditation and the Bible, and meditation and the Kabbalah. The library here, if you find anything in the library here, probably has at least one of those books. I'm not sure which one, but I'm sure one of the three is up there. Now, Rabbi Kaplan claimed a lot of benefits to meditation. He claimed that meditation was the main activity in the Nevi'im schools. We read in Tanakh, there was a group of people called B'nai HaNevi'im. Now, B'nai HaNevi'im means the children of the prophets, but that means the students of the prophets, which implied there were schools you went to learn prophecy. But how can you learn prophecy? Prophecy is a gift from Hashem, the Rambam says. I mean, no matter what your techniques, you know, you're not going to automatically be a prophet. So the Rambam explains that's true. A lot of people who graduated maybe didn't get the job of being a prophet. But the Rambam says, in addition to Hashem giving you gifts, there are techniques that make you receptive to receive nevuah. And Rabbi Kaplan claimed primarily there were different techniques of advanced meditation in which if you can get rid of the distractions, you could receive the divine light. So he claimed that that was hachana for nevuah. He also said that when the Mishnah in Brachos tells us that the Hasidim are Rishainim, the early pious people, these are not the Baal Shem Tov's Hasidim, this is much, much earlier, they used to spend an hour before davening, and then they would daven an hour and an hour after davening. He connected that to meditative states to be able to get into davening. So he claims that the notion of focused meditation has a very, very long Mesorah in Am Yisrael. And I can't necessarily judge it historically, but there's no question that... you know, whether you call it, really what you call it doesn't make a difference, but certainly taking time before tefillah to kind of focus the thoughts, calm yourself down, not to be agitated, not to be nervous, is the way that you can focus your thought. Now, there's an interesting machlokas among contemporary Gedolim, Rabbanim, Hasidish Rebbis about pacing. There are some Rebbis who actually take the position that, at least in their own Aveda, it's better to daven very quickly than very slowly. They actually daven. There are great Hasidic Rebbes who daven the Shemona Esrei like 3 minutes because they feel they can have this intense, focused concentration if they kind of stretch out the words. So long, long. You know, they stretch out the words, their mind is going to wander, so to speak. So there is a shita, better to daven quick than daven slow. Others say when you daven slow, you can concentrate, etc. Certainly, one of the problems we have when you go—I mean, when you go to yeshiva is slower than a shul balabatim. But certainly, when you go back to America, the pace in virtually every shul is going to be very, very difficult. And what's worse is—I mean, I know this—if you ever have to daven for the omelet in a fast shul, very, very, very uncomfortable. Because in addition to having to daven fast, which you can do, theoretically, it's possible to be focused and daven fast. But when you're nervous that somebody's going to be yelling at you, that creates a lot of anxiety, and that shoots down kavana. That really, what destroys kavana is the sense of somebody breathing down your back. So there's a whole shaila in halacha: should that pater me from tefillah b'tzibur? Meaning, if my only choice, because I don't have a million choices in most places in America, if my only choice is super fast minyan or davening b'yechidus. So it's an interesting shaila. Certainly, you should go to the minyan at least to hear Kaddish, Kedusha, Kriya, Sotara. I mean, that doesn't patter you. But the question is, the Etzem Tfila, some would say it's better to daven B'Yechidus, and then join the shul. Again, join the shul for Kaddish, Kedusha, Baruch Hu, and Kriya, Sotara. In fact, there were many Gedolim that did that. That's interesting. I mean, not so much among the literature. Many Hasidish, even the Chazon Ish often did. The Chazon Ish often did this. The Chazon Ish often daven B'Yechidus, and he would join. There was actually a minion in his house. He didn't daven in the minion in his house. And he would, like, come in different moments. So there is, again, you have to know. I mean, many people say that Bizman Azeh, we don't have such great Kavana anyway, even if we're by ourselves. So we really shouldn't use our need for Kavana to separate from the Tzibur. But there are times in which, like, I think the Chazon Ish's Eitzah actually was to a certain Bachur that twice a week he could take off to have his Iris as Dikat Tefillah, and the rest of the time he should be B'tzibur, even if it compromises his Kavana. But you should talk to your rabbi about it in terms of specifically how to appoint you. What about Rosh Hashanah?
It's for Parnassa.
Yeah.
Yeah. I heard it said that a person can be Pasheah, and if he doesn't do enough Ishmael, he can lose it. I've heard it said many times. I don't know where it comes from.
Well, I think, I think it's a Svara Memela, because the Gezerah of Rosh Hashanah is, thank you, the Gezerah of Rosh Hashanah is Gufa conditional. Meaning, what's the Gezerah? The Gezerah is, in fact, maybe multiple Gezerahs. If you do X, you'll get X. If you do Y, you'll get Y. Meaning to say, the Gezerah of Rosh Hashanah is not a Gezerah Mukhlat in the sense that no matter what you do, it's a Gezerah that's Mekusher to a certain Darga of Ishtaglis, which of course is, creates a total unknown equation. Now, you're right, the Chayvus HaLevavus is not mashma that way. The Chayvus HaLevavus is mashma, you're going to get what you're going to get. How will Hashem chesh ben ayis if you don't do hishtaglis? How is it going to work? I don't know. But the Chayvus HaLevavus is mashma, you're going to get what you're going to get. But the svarim that say you could be mafsid, it's not really, it's not a knas. It's based on the fact that the etzem gezeira itself is along a range of infinite possibilities, meaning HaKadosh Baruch Hu cheshbens the amount of hishtaglus, and the parnasa is makusher to that amount of
hishtaglus.
Huh? Where's the mucker? I have to see what the mucker is. I mean, it's brought down in many places. I would check. Maybe Rav Dessner may say this.
And it's also that the same thing applies to the Zerah 40 days before the
Well, there you see beferish in the Gemara. That's you don't even need a Rav Dessler. There you see beferish in the Gemara that you could be mafsid. The Gemara says you're allowed to make a shidduch even in the 9 days, because or chol ha'moed, because shema yikadmenu acher. Maybe somebody through tefillah will take away your basheret. So there you see for a davar pashut that one could be mafsid his basher either by a lack of zchus, or even if it's not a lack of zchus, somebody else has an extra zchus of a kayuch of tefillah. So there you have a beferish araya that can happen. And people used to ask the stipler, you know, I don't have my basher. He says, you met your basher 5 years ago, you didn't want to go out with her, or you didn't want to continue it. So it's vaday not the case that everybody marries that particular one that was nixer, but that doesn't mean Kodesh Baruch Hu then gives you a tachlif, and it can work in the second stage as well. Meaning it's not like a zivug sheni or whatever. Yeah.
What is a talmud chacham?
Well, you know, you know, the Ramah says, you know, talmud chacham has a lot of privileges in the Gemara. Doesn't have to pay taxes, all sorts of things. Although the IRS or even the Israeli taxing authority, the Mas, has not accepted that yet. But the Ramah says on that, nobody's a Talmud Chacham today, so Talmud Chacham have to pay their taxes. But the definition of a Talmud Chacham, well, again, like everything else, we throw around the words today. Rav Chaim Eiser once said, of course, Rav Chaim Eiser would get letters from all over the world, and the letters would have many, many titles. And of course, he was deserving of the titles. Rabban Shel Kol Bnei Hagoyla, you know, I mean, he was given the greatest titles. But he would laugh in his Anava. He would laugh and he would say, it reminded him, you know, if you remember in the Weimar Republic before World War II, after World War I, inflation was, I mean, that's really how the Nazis got into power. The inflation was so excessive that you had to use a billion marks to buy a loaf of bread. You may have seen a newsreel or pictures of people with wheelbarrows and wheelbarrows of money to get a piece of bread. So Rav Chaim Oyser says, the inflation of titles in the Torah world has reminded him of the inflation for bread in Germany, where, you know, a person who was a rab is now a rab hagoyin, and the person who was a goyin is a goyin hagoyin. You know, everything is, of course, from Chaim Oyser's case, that was, I would have to say, false modesty, but in some ways, everything is in inflation today. Here you have a guy in yeshiva, you know, who's been learning Gemara for 2 years. He gets engaged, Baruch Hashem, so we might say he's a fine Talmud Chacham, which, you know, again, maybe Baruch Hashem will be a fine Talmud Chacham, and the like. But the Rama says the definition of a Talmud Chacham is it's a big definition. It's a hard definition. It's someone that you can ask him anywhere in Shas, and he will be able to explain it to you. And it even adds, including Maseches Kala. Maseches Kala is not even part of the regular Shas. It's the Masechtos, the small Masechtos. They're like appendix Masechtos and the like. So the Chazon Ish explains what that means is, not just he could translate a line of Gemara, but it means in any sugi in Shas, he could give you the Iker, Gemara, and the Rishonim. The Iker. It doesn't mean, I mean, only the great, greatest Gedolim are holding in every sugya all the time, but he has to be able to address every, right? So, now that's the objective definition. Now, the truth of the matter is, in some ways, inflation is justifiable in the sense that when a door gets weaker and weaker, so we need to give chizuk to people. So when people finish a lot of Masechtos or learn a lot of Gemara, you know, they should get some recognition for their accomplishments. But a Talmud Chacham, according to the Ramah's definition, is you could ask him in, I think the Lashon is, Raiv Sugya Sashas, and he's able to be Meshif. Some have given a more limited definition. They have said he's able to be Meshif in three Sedarim of Shas. What are the three Sedarim of Shas, as you would guess? Nashim, Nezikin, Moed, because maybe Zerayim, Kachim, Taros, are... Although Zeram is very Nogea today in Eretz Yisrael, but for most of the Gullahs, it was not Nogea L'maisa, so we'll let him off the hook for Zeram, Kachim, Tyrus. But at least Nashim Moed, Nashim Nezikin, he should know. Now, one other thing I want to say about a Talmud Chacham, and that is, it's very, very interesting that literally, what is the translation of a Talmud Chacham? A Talmud Chacham, actually, it's an ambiguous translation. It could mean student of the wise, or it could mean a wise student, right? But either way, you'll notice that we call the person a Talmud. Now, you might say, I could say, for example, Rebbe Yoshev was the greatest Talmud Chacham of the generation, or Rebbe Avadi Yosef, whoever, you know, I'm not picking Gedolah, but whoever you want to pick as your Gadol. But it's funny, Talmud Chacham? Talmud? So the Bali Musar say a beautiful word. They say that the true sign of godless and Torah is no matter how much you know, you still want to learn. Meaning, you're still a Talmud. You still want to keep on going. Because when you think, I know it already, then by definition, you haven't reached that madrega. So the word Talmud Chacham is a very extraordinary term because it suggests that the Iker thing that's Koveya godless in Torah is the she'ifa, the desire to keep on going. That's why I remember... What does the Gemara say? The Gemara says that why are Talmidei Chachamim called fish? The pasuk fish. So it mentions that a fish lives in water. A fish is surrounded by water. But when it's raining and it looks like drops of water are hitting, the fish swim up to the top to take in a little more water. Now, the truth is they think it's worms. But it looks at least visually, it looks like they're going after the water. So too, a Talmud Chacham is surrounded with Torah. But he hears another vort, another ha'ara, another daher. He rushes. That's what they say. The art scroll got a publicity picture once. Really, they really could have used this in their advertising. Rebbe Yoshev was looking at the Hebrew Shatnistin, you know, the art scroll Hebrew version. And he was looking at, take a picture, you know, We have plenty of people who use our, you know, our Gemaras. Now, what was he looking at? I mean, here you have a person, he'd been learning, you know, almost 100 years. maybe he was learning 100 Gemara for 100 years. And he's looking at the art scroll. You know, what is he looking at? I mean, you know, even in the center, they don't let you look at the art scroll, right? But Yasser was looking, maybe the Hebrew they'll let you look at. But the answer is, this is mamish the example. You know, the guys who write the art scroll are chashuv kailo people who have done research and they've looked up Mara Makinas. So Rabbi Yasser is thinking, maybe I'll get something new. Amazing thing. That, like the fish. Maybe there's a little horror here. I'll learn from somebody who's 75 years, you know, younger than me. Maybe he came up with something. I'll just end with this. Rabbi Eliezer Silver, who was a great gadol, he came from Europe, and he came to America in the 1920s. So he was in America before World War II, and in fact, he was very influential in helping Jews out of the Holocaust and the like. His first shteller was in a New England town. I don't want to mention it because it's shtickel lashon hara on the town. And he was relatively young, and he was fired from the rabbinate in the 1920s. And the reason he was fired was he was spending night times in the synagogue learning Gemara, and they thought he was wasting electricity. They didn't want a rabbi who was wasting electricity. So when he said, well, you know, I'm learning, they said, ah, that's the whole point. You know, we want a rabbi who finished his education. You're learning, you're getting your degree at our expense? Get out of here. You know, we want somebody who knows his stuff. You know, so what can I tell you? Just the musag that, you know, you learn Torah and then you're finished and then you graduate is something that Baruch Hashem, I think, is so foreign to all of us that we understand that one keeps on going. So Bezus Hashem, we should all be zeichet to keep on going. I understand that, as Rav Reisman said, we too are in the army. People are debating, why don't yeshiva guys go in the army? The Yemen says, we are in the army and we should feel that we're in the army. Because the Avodas Hashem and the Torah that you learn is bringing Siyata Dishmaya and Bracha on Am Yisrael. And you should take it very, very seriously. And the same way that a military soldier cannot abandon his post, that's very, very serious. So too, a Ben Torah has to realize not to abandon post. That's why, at least in a small gesture, but Baruch Hashem, every moment has a chashivas, the yeshiva's extending the Zman, at least by a few days. Some chassidish places have literally canceled Bein Hazmanim. Now, if you ask, why don't we cancel Bein Hazmanim? So, this is a difficult shikol, meaning there is a logical reason that there ought not to be a Bein Hazmanim at all. But you also have to look at the long-term consequences, meaning if there's not going to be a Bein Hazmanim at all, Elul Zman, you know, people will be exhausted, tired. So, in a sense, you have to weigh every Rosh Hashiva has to weigh the qualitative benefits in learning by giving people a break versus the sacrifice in the quantity. And Mi Yemer, who says what's going to be a bigger zechus? Is it a bigger zechus that people can learn with more hislavos, or is it a bigger zechus to learn without interruption? Right? So these are difficult shikulim. And different Rabbanim, different Rosh Hashivas have come out different ways. But Rav Steinman, who is kind of the gadol that we're following, seems to indicate that we should try to compromise by it, both extending the Zman a little bit, but also still giving a Bein Hazmanim. But still, the Bein Hazmanim doesn't mean you have to be part of it. You are allowed to learn Bein Hazmanim. It's not usher to learn. And certainly, whatever a person is able to do, consistent with their needs for rest and the relaxation, which is a need, one should try to do, because again, we do need the schus of Torah in a time of great, great sakana. So anyway, I'm sorry, I can't stay. I would love to stay. I just want to wish everyone a tremendous yashikayach. I should give you much, much brachot. It's very, very beautiful that we see you. Okay. Yeah.